Hello and welcome back to the Technology Policy Institute's podcast, To Think Minimum. It's Friday, March 15th, 2024. I'm Tom Leonard, President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at TPI, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Scott Walston, TPI's President and Senior Fellow, and Senior Fellow Sarah O'Lam. Today, we're delighted to have as our guests Ginger Jin and Liad Wagman to talk about antitrust and more specifically, the Federal Trade Commission, where both of them worked. Ginger as director of the Bureau of Economics from January 2016 to July 2017, and Liad as senior economic and technology advisor from 2020 to 2022. Ginger is currently a professor of economics at the University of Maryland. From January 2019 to May 2020, she was on leave at Amazon as an Amazon scholar and senior principal economist. Liad is currently Dean of the Stewart School of Business at the Illinois Institute of Technology, and effective June 1st will be Dean of the Lally School of Management at RPI, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Congratulations on your new appointment, Liad, and welcome Ginger and Liad to the podcast. So each of you worked at the FTC at different times. Both of you, I think, experienced the transition working under chairs from different parties. Ginger, you started with Edith Ramirez, a Democrat, and then worked for time under Maureen Olhausen, a Republican. And Liad, you started under Joe Simons, a Republican, and continued for a while under the current chair, Lina Khan. And so perhaps each of you can start by briefly talking about your experience at the FTC, what your general view and impression of the agency was at the time that you worked there. Maybe start with you, Ginger.
Oh, sure. Yeah, thanks so much for having us. I was actually on sabbatical leave at Federal Trade Commission at the second half of 2015. Just happened that it was my sabbatical year and I have to be local and so forth. So I started there. I should clarify that most of my research is actually more related to consumer protection than to antitrust. So I was there on leave hoping to just working with FTC officials on consumer protection related issues. It just turns out that they were interested in me to taking the bureau director's position starting the beginning of 2016. So that really opened me to both the consumer protection issues as well as antitrust issues. So I really have the honor to work with a lot of career economists and lawyers, as well as commissioners, bureau directors in Competition Bureau and Consumer Protection Bureau on a lot of questions and covering both and part of the house. I really appreciate that experience. It's very educational to me. And after that, that experience does make me think more about antitrust issues and things that I have written a few articles about antitrust. Some with Liad, some with other people. Yeah, so I really appreciate that experience.
Yeah, I mean, so what was your, I mean, I worked at the FTC very briefly years ago, basically for about 6 months when, this will obviously date me, when Jim Miller was the chairman. But I found it to be it's a pretty intellectual place, isn't it, overall, compared to other government agencies?
Oh, definitely, definitely. It's almost like, it's kind of, to some extent, similar to academic department. In the Bureau of Economics, we have 80 plus PhD economists. Many of them are very active in research, not just the case-related research, but also research publishable in academia and journals and FTC Bureau of Economics and also other bureaus have constantly organizing conferences to learn and contribute to academic literature. So I very much feel it's a very intellectual place. It's also eye-opening for me as an economist to learn more on the legal side, like exactly how non-economists have been thinking about consumer protection and antitrust issues.
Liad, do you want to talk a little bit about your experience there and your general impressions of the agency at the time?
Yeah, I share a lot of Ginger's respect for the agency and impressions from it. It was really eye-opening for me to see how attorneys treated issues that I perceived as economic issues. It was nice to learn from their perspectives. I joined the Office of Policy Planning under Joe Simon and Bilal Sayed in the beginning of 2020. We've sort of begun conversations in 2019. And as you know, the pandemic caused massive changes in March of 2020. And the agency quickly went to fully remote. So there was a whole other aspect to the experience, kind of seeing the changes from 2019 and earlier when I went to the agency to provide, you know, testimony at hearings and other activities, to how the agency transformed into being fully remote during the pandemic. And of course, after the election, I also served under acting chair Rebecca Slaughter for a time, and then under Lena Khan for several more months before I left in January of 2022. My experience was more uniform, I would say, between Chair Simon and acting chair Slaughter. And then it kind of changed with the many changes that Lena Khan brought to the agency. It was most jarring, I think, in the beginning when there was a moratorium on participating in conferences or in advocacy. Those were ultimately relaxed with time, but I think some of the changes were just, you know, caused a little bit of kind of the staff, the career staff, especially being shell-shocked and not to be able to do what they used to do. So that's, you know, that's kind of just the high-level things. And overall, it was just a great experience to be able to participate in the activities of the agency, including with the Bureau of Economics, Bureau of Competition and Consumer Protection, and also within the Office of Policy Planning, we took on some studies under Section 6B of the FTC Act that enabled us to do things that were massive in scale, just kind of aspirational, but were still informative. One of those studies was on the acquisition activities of the five largest technology companies at the time, you know, over the past decade from 2010 to the end of 2019. And, you know, that was pretty insightful to see the capabilities of the agency and the teamwork of economists and lawyers and paralegals and technologists to pursue a very large project and see it to fruition and, you know, ultimately be able to share a little bit of the results with the public as well. It's a great experience.
Yeah, maybe we can get into that, because I know that was an important study, or maybe we can get into that in a little more detail later. But I'd like to start out with, I think this podcast will generally just focus on this paper that both of you have written, titled Preserving the Institutional Value of the FTC in the Digital Era, that is available on the TPI website, if any of our listeners want to get to it. But it's kind of an overall, it's kind of a big picture. It's got a lot of detail in it, and it's also got a lot of big picture stuff in it. And it's a very interesting paper. It basically focuses within the broader context of the FTC's history. It kind of focuses on the current FTC. So maybe you can, I don't know who wants to go first. You can kind of talk about what you think the major takeaways are from that paper. You want to start, Ginger?
Sure, I can start. I guess we wrote that piece, try to reflect what happened in the past a few years. I think FTC have gone through a lot of changes, both institutionally as well as in the continent-wide and in terms of their activities. As FTC alumni, I was always proud of being part of FTC and have seen really talented people there doing very valuable work. I still believe that FTC has a very unique position to make a very unique contribution as a government agency and public institution to the digital era. For one thing, I think FTC is unique as a bipartisan, more than 100-year-old agency, have kind of a dual mission in both antitrust and consumer protection. Digital era might be a very prime example where these two paths actually could intertwine in a very important way for the whole society. So in that sense, I feel like FTC has a very unique position, could make a lot of contribution in this area. Not just saying let's have blockbuster cases in the court as litigation, but also as a thought leader of how the society should think about these issues. As consumers facing challenges of, say, on one hand, they want to get a lot of valuable products and services from the digital suppliers. On the other hand, they may be concerned about their privacy issues in the digital data. I think FTC seems like a natural fit to really deal with that kind of challenge when antitrust and consumer protection really intertwine with each other. So that's kind of one of the motivation to write this article. In the article, and people can, they're free to check out the article to read the details. I think the main message I want to convey is I see the point that we want to reflect on what has been done in the past, maybe decades, and see what went well, what went wrong, how can we improve that system? And I'm all in that. But I hope that can be done in a more systematic way. For example, if we're thinking, okay, consumer welfare standard may need some reform, and let's ask exactly where that standard was wrong and why it's wrong. How can we fix it? I was hoping FTC can be a thought leader in providing a coherent overarching framework on that. If the whole society wants to reflect on that issue and have a better improved framework to address the future challenges in the digital era. So that was my hope for the FTC reform. I mean, unfortunately, I see some action towards that direction, but not probably not as comprehensive and as fast as I had wished.
Yeah, you wanna?
Yeah. You know, totally in agreement with Ginger's statements. I think we've had a number of works in the broader space of antitrust and consumer protection. And I think this paper kind of ties some of them together to provide an overarching commentary on the recent developments at the commission. I think that the commission is just immensely impactful on the American and the global economy. And every little action that it takes can have massive consequences, some intended, some unintended. And it's just crucial to apply the economic lens to the decisions and ensure that they're leading to a desired outcome. You know, I think that applies, at least in the paper, primarily in the technology context, that's first, you know, fast moving and has been our focus in a number of other papers. And so we kind of try to shed a specific light on the technology context and the agency's actions in that context in recent years.
Well, I mean, it's not a secret that the current chair, Lina Khan, came in wanting to shift course quite dramatically. She didn't make any secret about that. I mean, I don't know who. I think she probably, as well as her counterparts at the DOJ, you know, have said, you know, that the last 40 years of antitrust have been a failure, and she's trying to correct that. So, I mean, you know, within that, first of all, do you think we need such dramatic correction, or just more minor corrections? And secondly, how successful do you think? Talk about how successful you think the current leadership is going to be at transforming antitrust enforcement. We hear a lot more about antitrust enforcement rather than the consumer protection side. And you don't really write about the consumer protection side in your paper, but I mean, you kind of talk about the administrative actions, and you talk about the cases. The way I like to segment your paper, and then you talk about the more general kind of reputational aspects of the FTC. So maybe talk about whichever one of those you'd like to talk about first.
Well, maybe I can just talk about a big picture. I feel like as an economist, we want to appreciate a more balanced view of benefits and the cost of agency actions. For example, in the draft and final merger guidelines just published last year, there are a lot of cans and mays. I mean, in theory, it's probably not hard to write out a theoretical model saying that theoretical possibility could happen under certain conditions. But to move it into practice, I think we have to consider how likely that can and may might be. What's the consequence if this turns out to be false positive? To what extent we may, say, deter innovations or even lessen the competition because of the action? So I think I want to see a more balanced benefits-cost analysis in the actions such as antitrust cases or rulemaking or some proposal of merger guidelines or HSR reporting criteria. I think every action here, and we can have a very long list of potential costs and potential benefits. And overall, I think a balanced view will be better than approach that's we go for a particular direction, assuming that is correct, and sometimes even with a very explicit presumption, and then just say that's okay, we're going that direction. If other parties want to against it, you can raise your hand and rebuttal it. I think as an agency, as a, such an important agency, try to really benefit American society in the digital era. I think some inherent benefits cost analysis is really necessary.
I mean, you talk about.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I was just going to add. I think this is this has been a jarring change. There's less reliance on such cost benefit analysis. You know, under Chair Khan, that used to be the precursor to changes. Right, the commission would hold workshops. It would gather input from the community. It would rely on the economics literature to inform its cost benefit analysis, and that has sort of been moved to the side. At least that is my sense of things.
So you think the role of economics in general has been moved to the side, or not?
Well, I think it's there are attempts to do so. At least that's my sense of things. You know, some of it is reflected in the new merger guidelines. Some of it is reflected in the way that proposed rulemakings are conducted, with you know, with a certain approach that omits certain steps that used to be taken in order to gather that sort of input. You know, an example is the non-compete rulemaking, which sort of, you know, does not take into account the extant economic literature in making sweeping changes with you know, various potential consequences, again, without taking into account the cost-benefit analysis.
Let me ask a question that's a little bit unfair, possibly, because it's so speculative. But Trump is well known for his total disdain of any existing institution, you know, if it's not something that benefits him. And, you know, maybe it's a little extreme to compare what's happening at the FTC to that. But is it part of a trend of not understanding the importance of the stability of our institutions and the history and their foundations and how they became what they are, if it doesn't match exactly what you hope to do? Obviously, that's an incredibly leading question and not exactly a fair one, but does that kind of ring true to you or not? I mean, is there hope to reverse this, I guess, maybe is the more optimistic way to put it.
I would say good news is that the commission is at least moving from being entirely majority commissioners, you know, at least based on recent reportings, right, and moving towards having the minority commissioners appointed as well. So I guess that's good news. But I would just point out that at least as far as the FTC is concerned, from my perspective, having worked under, you know, two administrations from opposing political parties, that this trend is not unique to any one party.
Another example is if you compare the draft merger guidelines and the final merger guidelines, I think it's a good sign that the final merger guidelines looks more balanced and has more writings and also acknowledge some economic literature. That may be a result of having the draft merger guidelines available to the public. It actually received many, many public comments. And not only those get filed at the FTC website or DOJ website, but also we know a lot of professional conferences, a lot of professional panel discussions really, and have people talking about the pros and cons in the draft merger guidelines. So I think that speaks to the strengths of having multiple voices, right? I think this is a democratic process. That's different mindset contributing to the same question would help us have a more balanced work product that would avoid maybe not necessary uncertainties if people just go with one direction until somebody else protests. I think that's a very probably costly way for the whole society to figure out what's right and what's wrong. It could be very costly to the agency. It could be very costly to the businesses or parties that got questioned by the agencies, but also very costly for even average consumers like you and me, because if we have to resolve things by, say, okay, the district court says this, and that's pushing back on the plaintiff or the defendant. And then the appeal court says something different, and the Supreme Court would come in maybe years later to have their opinion, and then the case goes back to district court. I think this, the time cost we're paying, the kind of monetary cost, and also intellectual costs we're paying in that process is, in my opinion, is probably not necessary as compared to this. We already have an institution to facilitate for public comments, to really have open debate, and to try to drive to a work product that's more balanced even before we put that into action.
So you at the time you wrote your paper that the guidelines had not been finalized, so you were commenting on the draft guidelines, and you particularly singled out the treatment of potential competition as problematic. Do you think that was fixed in the final version?
I would say probably going towards the right direction, but not in the full extent as I would prefer. For example, there has been in the draft merger guideline, there were language like this is presumed anti-competitive or something like that. I think that kind of language has been struck off the final merger guidelines, but still the list of what they called objective or subjective evidence for potential entrance, I think the mindset is still there. I would wish that mindset has more balance in terms of benefits cost analysis than just saying, here's the direction we're going.
Yeah, this might be related to, you know, the study, the GAFAM study, I think, that you were referring to earlier. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how that may relate to the either to the guidelines or the overall approach towards mergers?
Sure. So that particular study, we looked at the five firms, Google or Alphabet, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Meta or Facebook. And we looked at their acquisition activities over the 10 years from 2010 to the end of 2019. And basically looked very, very deep into their acquisitions. I think each acquisition had over 100 questions linked to it that the respondents had to complete. And it included questions that had to do with the parameters of the transaction, but also what became of the acquired product or service. And it didn't just focus on acquisitions in the sense of acquiring majority shares in a company, but also minority acquisitions, also board rights and various other transactions like that. And there was a team that was working on this.
This included maybe even focused on non-reportable acquisitions.
Oh, it focused on non-reportable. Yeah, good point. Thanks, Tom. It focused on non-reportable acquisitions, transactions that would not have been filed to the agencies, to the FTC or DOJ under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. So these are non-reportable. That means usually they meet some sort of an exemption. Either they're relatively small in size or they have some other exemption. For instance, they don't have enough of a nexus to the United States. They don't meet other sort of tests. And the vast majority of these transactions were relatively small. We're talking less than $50 million. There were some that were larger. The size of transaction exemption under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act can go for some transaction in recent years almost up to $400 million. So theoretically, some transactions could be close to the $400 million range, which is not necessarily small, but they might still go unreported. There weren't that many such transactions anywhere in that range, very few. So the point of the study was to look at these transactions to see if the agencies are really missing out something important by not having those transactions be reportable to the agencies ahead of the merger taking place. The output that was published from this study didn't really touch on that. It more had some summary statistics of the transactions. It did have some conclusions, at least in the sense of reporting data, regarding whether there were potential loopholes used for non-reporting. For instance, if certain debt was taken in order to not report, or extraordinary dividends were issued, or the key employees or the founders of the acquired companies received some contingent pay after the acquisition was consummated. And it didn't seem that those affected any large percentage of transactions, at least based on the public report. So that was kind of the public output. But since that study came out, Ginger and I and another co-author of ours, Mario Lacchesi, we worked on a number of papers in this space that looked at data that's available from databases like Refinitiv, like S&P, like Crunchbase, to dig.
Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you? I don't mean to interrupt, yeah. But I was just curious because so the study started out as this is more of an institutional question about the FTC. So the study started out under Joe Simons, as I understand.
That's right.
And then was released when Lina Khan was chair.
It was released in the summer of 2021. It was voted out unanimously. I believe, yes, Lina Khan was chair at the time.
So that transition, would you say that transition affected or did not affect the final product that was released?
Well, I don't have the counterfactual, so I don't know what would have been released if Simon was still chair. but yes, so to continue on, we went on to study similar kind of environment, the same 10 years of acquisition activity using data that's available through databases that anyone can access with a license. And we did what the study didn't do, which is put the acquisitions by the five large technology companies in context, in the broader context of the technology space. And we obtained results there that, one would have hoped the FTC would have provided, but did not. So some of those results go into the benchmarking of acquisitions by those large technology companies against other leading technology companies and the potential impact of those transactions on competition or entry into a business area by other technology companies.
So the data that the FTC gathered through the 6B process is not publicly available, and you couldn't use it after you left the agency, right?
That's right. So the study that the agency is able to release under 6B is really anonymized, right? It doesn't show firm-specific information. It is able to aggregate across firms to show aggregate data, aggregate patterns, but not firm-specific.
So how would you say what either the result of the 6B study or the result of the studies that you did afterwards based on the public databases, how should they inform merger policy?
Yeah, I think it's nice to point to maybe a specific case. We looked at for instance, the FTC and the Meta within transaction, right? As an example in this paper, I think zooming in on that case in particular, it was interesting to me that the agency pursued a transaction in a technology area where the primary form of exit is through an acquisition. And, targeting such a transaction can have ramifications for innovation in the space in the first place, because entrepreneurs, investors may not choose to get into something where the primary form of exit, we're talking about a ratio of something along the lines of 32 acquisitions to one IPO, is being foreclosed, is being shut down through regulatory efforts that, like the Meta within acquisition. So to me, it was of concern that we want to encourage innovation, we want to encourage entry. These are things that are positive for markets, for competition, for consumers, and regulatory actions such as this particular one could risk that for relatively little gain. So that was my opinion of the case. It's just an example. And the results from the papers support that acquisitions, for instance, by the leading technology companies in a particular business area do not necessarily disincentivize other incumbents from also acquiring in the same area and entering through acquisition into that area. And in fact, competition among those large technology companies has been increasing over time, competing within that group of GAFAM firms, but also with other large technology incumbents.
Yeah, so if I can complement Leah's description of that paper, if we zoom out to the big picture, I understand why agency and the media focus on the very few handful number of big companies. However, if you look at the whole universe maybe I shouldn't say the whole universe, at least the big chunk of tech acquisitions, as we can capture in the public databases, the GAFAM acquisition only account for less than 2% of tech acquisition deals in those data. Okay, we see a lot other acquirers. Some of them are very big, and like AT&T or Verizon, and some of them are relatively smaller, right? But our point is that the whole space of tech acquisition is much wider than just the corner of GAFAM acquisition, as the 6B study has described. And if you're talking about the incentive of entrepreneurs, as Leah described, their exit strategy count much more on M&A than IPOs. And this is more so over time, as documented by the finance literature. At the same time, the R&Ds has been moved from big enterprise labs such as the Bell Lab to a lot of smaller startups funded by venture investors. So if you look at that ecosystem, being able to do R&D based on venture investment, be able to have an exit strategy through M&A is crucial for their incentive to start a business, to start a startup in the first place. Okay. So with that background, if you look at guideline number 4 in the merger guidelines, which targets on potential entrants. Okay. So they have a list of objective or subjective evidence saying that's okay. If you have been operating an adjacent area, you may be a potential entrant. Okay. If you have considered entering, even if you may have concluded that entering is not the right way to do, you may consider it as a potential entrant. So with all this list of evidences, that guideline seems to suggest that, okay, any merger involving those potential entrant might be anti-competitive. However, for a startup who is, let's say, competing with a big incumbent, maybe they're counting on M&A as a strategy for them to exit, to for them to have incentive to innovate in this space. And from the future acquirer's perspective, maybe this is an effective way for them to enter into a place to really compete with another big incumbent so that we can intensify the competition, promote competition in that area, right? So these are all kind of potential pro-competitive benefits of such M&As involving potential entrant. And going back to my point, that's we want a balanced view of thinking potential benefits in this area and potential anti-competitive harm in this area. And we want to somehow do a thorough benefit cost analysis, right? Especially if we want to have a rule of thumb saying that's exactly what action you want to have in this area. That's you want to encourage innovation. You don't want to minimize the entrepreneur's incentive to innovate in the future market, right? And the guideline as it's written right now, even in the final version, runs a risk of sort of counter that incentive. So that's the one that I wish the final guideline has revised.
Right. And Ginger is touching on another paper we wrote that explores who acquires startups, who acquires these young technology companies across the economy. And we found that companies across sectors, from manufacturing to trade and so on, acquire technology companies at times as a way to differentiate their products and compete more effectively, right? So it's something that is not specific to, say, the information sector. These kinds of acquisitions are something we see across sectors of the economy. I think it goes to Ginger's broader point about cost-benefit analysis. The agency has taken some actions, whether it's through court cases like the Meta Within case or by withdrawing the vertical merger guidelines so quickly after they were released and releasing new guidelines that depart from certain agency practices and approach to the guidelines in recent years. You know, this kind of these actions also create uncertainty in the marketplace, uncertainty for acquirers, uncertainty for entrepreneurs, uncertainty for investors. And that can lead to unintended consequences or maybe intended consequences for the marketplace that can be detrimental. And it seems that those costs have not been looked at either in a cost-benefit analysis before the agency takes certain actions.
Let me to kind of conclude the discussion, although this probably opens up a much broader discussion, but let me just read a quote from your paper that I think is what you wanted to leave readers with. It says that the FTC could, quote, serve as a thought leader in substantive, I think you you're suggesting they've missed this they're missing this opportunity, that they could serve as a thought leader in substantive antitrust reforms. The agency could do so by, one, initiating a much needed technological overhaul and digital transformation to serve as a model for all government agencies, particularly antitrust agencies, and two, leading a productive public discussion on how to modernize antitrust enforcement to be more consistent with the vibrant digital economy. I think maybe that was the message you wanted to leave in terms of what the FTC could do, kind of on a positive, or you hoped the FTC could do on a positive note. Do you want to maybe just expand a little bit on what you mean by those specific suggestions?
Yeah, and I feel like FTC is a rulemaker or regulator in the whole economy, right? Including the digital economy. I think it seems no-brainer that that agency should know what's going on in the field. Okay. However, from my personal experience and maybe from Leah's experience as well, we feel like the agency is really lagged behind technology-wise as well as intellectual-wise in terms of what's going on in the field, right? Our paper, the paper we just discussed about acquisitions, is only one aspect of what's going on in the venture investment market. There are many other aspects in the digital economy of exactly what technology has been used by big and small digital firms and how they exactly use them, right? And to what extent we have algorithm involved. I feel like the field is moving so fast. And given today's technology, well, the technology toolkits that agencies like FTCs are using, it's still in sort of the old traditional world, right? That's where they're still getting data based on case by case through the CID and the case investigation, right? And they got the consumer complaint reporting system, but those reporting systems are not being monitored in the real time to give cues on what the new violations that are happening in the real field, what cases should be quickly brought out to reflect those complaints. And these are just examples, right? I feel like as agency who try to kind of regulate or lead the digital economy, they really need the technology toolkits to really understand the market first, and then maybe using a benefits cost analysis to decide what are the most productive direction to go.
Right. The FTC has a huge opportunity to be a data generator for both consumer protection and antitrust issues, and provide this data more broadly to the research community to be able to advance the discussion forward and do meaningful analysis. And for one reason or another, it has not gotten to that point. And you know, that opportunity remains there and can be tapped. So I think that is one of our points here.
And not only on data collection and data dissemination, I mean, FTC could even operate as a platform, right? You could have the industry practice as one hand, you could have academic researcher as another type of users, you could even have policymakers, including and not limited to antitrust agencies, as even the third type of user here, right? I mean, all these parties could be interacting in terms of have a better understanding of the economy, and also the knowledge, let's say, accumulated by academia could be very useful to the policymakers. And the questions that policymakers see in the field, but they do not have resource to address, could be addressed by academia researchers or think tanks like you guys, right? I feel like FTC could play a role, try to connect those dots together and organize the thoughts, the intellectual thoughts and advances from different type of players in the society. And that's, in my opinion, that's they could have done more in that opportunity.
I mean, they now have more money, so they could, right, do more of what you're suggesting, right? Because that costs money, right?
Yeah, of course. And to that credit, actually, FTC, Bureau of Economics, will hold a conference on public policy and marketing, co-organized with me and Kay Sudhir in Yale Marketing Department. So that's kind of one effort that we could bring academia and public policy makers together to look at the marketing literature, the information economics literature to address public policy issues. And in terms of resources, it actually does not spend that much for this kind of conferences. It's probably more just we use some conference room in FTC, right? And have such conference announcement on the FTC website, we could attract academia from not only US, but also Europe and other parts of the world to really look at the questions. I mean, what's the cost for FTC that they, if they can define a list of questions that academia should look into, right? They don't even need to really provide very detailed transaction level data to the researchers. Often the academia researchers, like, they want to contribute, right? They even sort of want to have their own resources to answer interesting questions to policymakers if those questions could be well defined by policymakers. So again, that's, I feel like there are a lot of complementarity that could be led by agency like FTC to really kind of synthesize those thoughts and put them in a good use.
In your paper, you mentioned that the digital economy is 10% of GDP now, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis from 2021, and growing at around 10% as well. I mean, it seems like most of the economy has a digital component, but for it to be purely digital economy, 10%, you know, is a lot. Do you think that the FTC is like currently trending like European? Like, I know that you've both done a lot of work on European regulation, and there have been news reports like Chair Khan, you know, is meeting with the EU regulators a lot. Is that one way to interpret, you know, what's happening at, could the FTC in a different world take a more American approach? Are they going more of the European approach with the digital economy?
I don't know that we're taking a European approach. I think that might be up to Congress to decide rather than the FTC. But certainly there are questions of mutual interest concerning the digital economy. And Europe has been moving with some laws like GDPR, like the DMA, like the DSA, and the recent AI Act much quicker than Congress has. Right? So that does have some implications for the FTC. For instance, the FTC might explore using rulemaking as a way to advance certain priorities. It's really not ideal, though. That really should be something that Congress pursues in order to more wholly represent the interests of the American citizens.
Well, I think one positive impact out of the recent FTC and actions is it does generate a lot more attention to antitrust reforms, to the digital economy, to how the traditional framework of antitrust may not be the perfect fit for today's digital economy. I think that's a positive factor. It does motivate a lot of academia researchers from economics, from business school, from many other disciplines, even including computer science, to look into those issues. So I think that's a good thing. I mean, hopefully that could be good inputs into the eventual benefits cost analysis at the Congress, for example.
Well, I think we probably have gone over the amount of time that we had promised we would take from you guys. And we really, this has been a very interesting discussion. This is a very, your paper is very interesting. Let me repeat the title for our listeners. It's called Preserving the Institutional Value of the FTC in the Digital Era, and it is on our website. It's going to be published in a forthcoming issue with a few other papers in the Review of Industrial Organization. And thank you very much. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay.